Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning, and welcome to The Show on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, why a political consultant thinks Latino caucuses could one day be a thing of the past.
And how one novelist captures life on the border by trying not to think about it.
But first, President Trump yesterday announced new tariffs ranging from 10% to nearly 50% on goods coming into the U.S. Some global markets have already shown effects of the move. European and Asian stock markets opened lower today, as did those in this country. With me now to talk through this, as well as new research showing the potential impact of Medicaid cuts in Arizona, is economist Jim Rounds of Rounds Consulting Group. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning.
So what do you make of these tariffs? Like, what kind of impact might they have specifically on Arizona?
Well, most people are now understanding the way tariffs work is that it's a tax imposed on the company within the U.S. that's importing the products, which means the costs get passed on to us. So we're really paying the tax. The thing that's kind of left out hanging is the fact that we knew this was going to happen. The stock market reacted pretty severely this morning as if it didn't know this was going to happen. But I think when things hit reality, it still shocks people just a bit. There's not much to shock us anymore. I mean, in the last month or two, have you heard anything politically that is shocking anymore? No. But I think it's not just the tariffs. It's a combination of tariffs, certain tax cut or certain spending cuts. There's everything in the aggregate. People are starting to put these issues together and they're realizing, all right, we're probably going to see a recession in the next year, year and a half. But I don't expect that the huge dips in the stock market that happened today are going to stay at this level. I think we're going to have a little bit of a bounce back, and then we're just going to see this bouncing like a ball on a tile floor. It's just going to keep bouncing and bouncing for a while.
So you mentioned, Jim, the R word, which I know economists love to talk about, recession. And there has been talk recently of increased odds, according to some economists, of the U.S. going into a recession. Are you one of those economists who believes that as well?
Well, we've been doing such a great job. I mean, we predicted, 10 of the last zero recession. So up until now, we've been looking for it. But the difference, though, is that we didn't have a recession because the government spent an extra $10 trillion over the prior 4 years and added that to the national debt. That buoys the economy quite a bit when your entire GDP during that period was only $25 trillion in each year. So we would have had one already, most likely. We were headed towards slowing, but not necessarily like a cliff that you would see during a recession, then you bounce back out of it. So the economy is slowing. This is going to add to it. It is going to reduce economic activity. This isn't going to be a short-term solution. I've been hearing from individuals saying that this is going to range between a one-month and a three-month kind of adjustment period. This is going to last for years. This is not something that's just going to go away.
Jim, specifically in Arizona, are there particular sectors of the economy or industries or maybe even products that we tend to buy a lot of in Arizona that you think might be more affected by these tariffs than others?
Well, the big ones in terms of percentage that get imported from outside the country, we have like a lot of machinery and electronic parts because they go into the things that we build. So if you're heavy in a particular industry, then you're going to see the increase in costs coming soon. If you already have your computer and you don't need a new one for a while, you're good. If you already have a car and it's paid off, you're good. But when you have to start making new transactions, you're going to see it. But food's a big thing that we also import from Mexico. There's lumber and other things like that, the plastics from Canada. What do those go into? They go into housing. So it's pretty much across the board. I tell people when they ask this question, walk around your house or walk around your office or just kind of look at things as you're driving around town. And if you see something with steel, aluminum, wood, all the different things that the tariffs would impact, expect that when those have to get replaced or rebuilt, the prices are going to be higher for a little while.
Interesting. So, Jim, I want to also ask you about an economic analysis you did on behalf of the Arizona Chamber Foundation, looking at the potential impact on the Arizona economy if the federal government cuts its Medicaid spending. And I want to read to you a quote that you have, which is, "This particular policy issue is the single greatest economic development threat we've analyzed since the Great Recession more than a decade ago." That seems pretty serious.
It is serious. And the tariffs, obviously, are a big impact on the economy. They cut I think the target was upwards of $1 trillion. They end up cutting that from all these different states, and they end up cutting several billion dollars from us. The obvious answer is going to be that money's not going to be flowing around. It's going to cause the healthcare industry to crater in the rural parts of the state, and with some of the hospitals and facilities, it's going to be impacting lower income individuals. It's going to be impacting small businesses, but in reality, it's impacting everybody. No, I don't care how well your business is doing; these costs are going to flow back up, and we're going to have fewer healthcare choices, and we're going to have higher costs. So, this is something that's going to impact everybody. I wish that it was being talked about more, because there is nothing that we analyze that could have this big of an impact. And that includes, we're the ones that did the analysis when we had that California income tax proposal to hike our income tax rate way up, and everybody was freaking out over it. And these numbers, those numbers weren't as big as these. So I think the economic development community needs to really get on this. I'm glad that the Arizona Chamber and the Foundation are wanting to look at this.
Is this a function of sort of how pervasive the healthcare industry is, and sort of how much it impacts in general healthcare, the rest of the economy?
That's one signal, but the bigger thing that I take from it is the federal government, and I firmly believe in this. I think there's a lot of government waste, and we have to try to address that. But you can't just go through and arbitrarily say we're going to go ahead and just cut the heck out of this one area, and yeah, we'll expect a recession, but it's going to be cleansing, and then we'll come out of it on the better end. No, if you have a government forced recession, if it's done poorly, you don't have a coming out the back end. You have a long term period where things are going to be weaker. So I think it's more of, and I love the concept of DOGE. I hate how it's being implemented. You can't just make haphazard reviews and then do these huge cuts without analyzing what are the repercussions. And they're not analyzing a damn thing. All they're doing is they're making these cuts. But again, I'm big on getting rid of government waste. Every time I go through tax season, I look at that number and I think, am I getting these services, or is somebody else in another country getting these services for what I'm spending? But my goodness, we have to be a little bit more cautious about how we do this, because we don't want to hurt the economy. Everything the president says is, let's help build the economy. Tariffs longer term, we want to help build the economy, but we might have a recession. This Medicaid cut combined with the tariffs, it's bad news.
Interesting. All right. We'll have to leave it there. That is Jim Rounds of Rounds Consulting Group. Jim, good as always to talk to you. Thank you.
Take care, man.
The Arizona Legislature's Latino Caucus has been the source of some controversy this year. In a nutshell, the group held an election for chair, which was won by a Democratic lawmaker. But after that vote, one member realized a lawmaker who should have been allowed to vote was not, and called for a revote. A GOP member decided not to take part in that revote, and a different Democratic lawmaker won the second election for chair. Our next guest has been thinking about the purpose and makeup of Latino caucuses in state legislatures across the country. Mike Madrid is a GOP political consultant and author of The Latino Century. He recently wrote a piece on his Substack asking if these kinds of caucuses should be bipartisan. Madrid joins me to talk more about this. And Mike, how common or uncommon is it for these legislative Latino caucuses to be either bipartisan or not?
Yeah, it's really a function of the state. It's a great question, because in many ways, looking at what each state is doing and is how they're handling these ethnic caucuses gives us an understanding of where each demographic population is. So, for example, California has always had, for 50 years now, a Latino legislative caucus. it's not explicitly delineated as a Democratic caucus, but only Democrats are allowed in. We're now seeing the rise of more Latino Republicans who are saying, oh, we'll have to start our own caucus because if you won't allow us to be bipartisan, we can't allow you to frame being Latino or Hispanic as a partisan endeavor. And so we want to give voice our opinions to the public policy space. But other states, Arizona and Texas included, have been bipartisan historically. There have been some challenges along the way. Florida, the third largest Latino state in the country, actually got rid of its caucus. It had a caucus, but it was so overwhelmingly Republican that there was no difference between what policy positions the Hispanic caucus in Florida was taking and the overall Republican conference. So they just let it go. States like Illinois have a Latinx, Chicanx caucus, which is only allows Democrats. And then New York has a really peculiar blend, but it's somewhat understandable. They have a Black, Latino, and Asian Pacific Islander caucus altogether. And so that's essentially the five largest Hispanic states. That's the way that they've been tackling the problem, the challenge or opportunity, I should say.
What is the point of these caucuses? And I wonder if maybe that mission or the point of them has changed, as you point out, as, you know, more Latinos are becoming Republicans.
You know, Mark, that's such a good question because, you know, as a young Republican staffer in the late 1990s in California, we first brought up that first issue, which was saying, wait a second, Republicans should be allowed in the caucus. We had just elected the first Latino Republican in 150 years in California. And we were just summarily dismissed and said, no, this is just for Democrats only. 30 years later, you know, my whole opinion on this has changed because I've been watching throughout my career all of these demographic transformations happening state by state. And I'm now of the belief that, you know, Latinos are really not that much different than any other group. And so tying ethnicity to a partisan endeavor is really more destructive. It's more harmful than it is helpful. So you should either have a bipartisan caucus or two separate caucuses, or ultimately, where I think this is all heading to your bigger point, to having no caucuses at all, just working on making the legislature work. I think there does need to be, in retrospect, some understanding that the demographic change that this country has undergone over the past 30 years is unprecedented, and it has been extraordinary. And it really is, in many ways, a bigger story about how we identify and view ourselves with our own American identity. We are not all the same. That's okay, but we can come back under the umbrella of Americanness while also respecting those differences.
I want to cite something that you had written, which is that you say a truly representative Latino caucus seems incompatible with both major parties. And it seems like that kind of speaks to what you were just talking about in terms of the kinds of policy ideas that might come out of a particular caucus based on its partisan makeup relative to what the voters actually want.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's kind of like saying, well, if you had a white caucus, that somehow that caucus would come up with all the exact policy positions that all white people would suggest are right. That's impossible, and it should be impossible. And I wrote that because the idea that somehow one political party has the province and keen insight and understanding and the willingness to advocate for all of the policy positions that, you know, polling and research and history tells us is really nonsensical. And that's what we're discovering, is in many ways Democrats are much more in line with the Latino voter when it does come to a pathway to citizenship, for example, or for investments in healthcare and the K-12 system. Republicans are much better in line on housing affordability, energy costs, lowering the cost of living and pocketbook issues, economic pocketbook issues. So it's really a blend. And that's why I said if there was genuinely a caucus, there would have to be an effort to prioritize your ethnicity over your partisanship. And that seems an impossibility in modern America.
Do you see this in some way, and it sounds as though you do, that this is in some way sort of symbolic of the divide among Latino voters now, that it's a much more diverse voting bloc than maybe it has been at least seen as and perceived as in the past?
That's exactly what it is. And I think one of the really fascinating corollaries to that observation is the whole concept of minority, quote unquote minority is changing in this country. The whole concept of an ethnic identity that is non-white is changing as America becomes much, much more diverse.
So what do you think the future of Latino caucuses is? Like, do you think at some point they're just in general going to go away?
I think we're going to see more caucuses develop, especially in states where there has not been a very large Latino population, states like Tennessee and Montana, Utah. And then eventually, in very short order, some of these larger states, yes, will in fact let them go and realize there's really no practical purpose to having this sort of differentiation based off of ethnicity when Latinos are the largest ethnic plurality in the states like California and Texas and soon Arizona, Florida. Like all of these states, if Latinos are the largest ethnic plurality, it really begs the question, what is the purpose, what is the point of having an ethnic caucus?
So I was going to ask if you see any parallels between what's been going on and what you see going on in the future with Latino caucuses, with other types of caucuses, like a Black caucus or a Native American caucus. But it sounds as though for groups that are still sort of in the minority in their particular states, maybe there is a place, or at least more of a place, for those than there might be for a Latino caucus.
That's exactly right. And all this comes down to is what we call racial polarization. When you can demonstrate that there are distinct and unique differences from a racial or ethnic minority, I think there's a lot of legitimacy and credibility to saying this group does need to have a particular policy voice that is distinct with a platform to give it a voice, especially, and this is important in those two subgroups, African Americans and Native Americans, the size of those populations are not growing and they haven't grown in 150 years. And in that case, yes, I think there's absolutely a place to have a caucus that advances this, the policy concerns, priorities, and agenda for a group that is not, essentially assimilating into this broader mainstream. Latinos present a very different dynamic. Virtually all of the non-white growth in this country is attributable to Latinos.
All right, we'll have to leave it there. That is Mike Madrid, GOP political consultant, co-host of the Latino Vote podcast. Mike, good as always to talk to you. Thank you.
Mark, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5 FM. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, humans have been selectively breeding dogs and cats for centuries. One company aims to take it a step further.
If the company unveils that to the public, I think, is going to kind of have to decide here about whether this is okay or not.
Why one biohacker wants to use gene editing to make rabbits glow.
But first, last week, I was reading this fascinating piece in Border Chronicle. It was called Uncanny Rio Grande Valley. It was a book review of sorts. The author, Caroline Tracy, was reflecting on the ways that the fiction of writer Fernando Flores has transformed her perception of borderlands literature. Flores has written a series of novels. His most recent is called Brother Bronte, and he's also written a short story collection called Valley-esque. And the quote from Tracy's piece that grabbed me was this, quote, "Flores's work came into my hands at a moment when I had decided that the borderlands evaded literature. The problem, as I had diagnosed it, was that the novel is a personal form, while the border is a societal phenomenon. No character could do justice to the structural forces that loom over the region," end quote. So I got this idea. What if we could get Caroline Tracy and Fernando Flores on to talk about why this particular region has been underserved by fiction and how Flores has found a way to capture what other work seems to miss? Much to my delight, they both agreed to join us, but the conversation went a little differently than I thought it would. I started off by asking Caroline to expand on that quote. How, I asked her, had she arrived at this conclusion that the borderlands evade literature?
It was a thought that was coming out of working as a journalist and covering things like, for instance, migrant death at the border, right? These really high numbers in Arizona and Texas of people that have died, thinking about the fact that you couldn't capture that sort of like systemic phenomenon in the story of one individual person in the way that a novel would probably set out to do. when I read Flores's work for the first time, it really felt like a kind of revelation, because I was feeling a little bit pessimistic about the ability of novels to capture the border.
Fernando, let me ask you, I'm curious to get your take on that idea that the novel as a form is a difficult means to write about complex systems as opposed to complex characters. When you sit down to tell a story like the one you're telling in Brother Bronte, or the stories that you're telling in Valley-esque, or any of your other works, is character a principal motivator for you, or are you trying to paint a world? Are you trying to speak to social issues that animate your point of view?
No, I'm never trying to insert my own agenda or my own little train of thought even into the storytelling. For me, it's always trying to connect to the once upon a time. Once upon a time, this certain person existed in a certain place. And that's when it becomes interesting to me, when I'm like, why can't I stop thinking about this person and this place? What is this place and who is this person? You know, so my pursuit of that, those answers, ends up being the novel itself. And the reason, and you can't escape the reason, maybe there's like political things in there, is just because maybe our lives are just surrounded by it and you don't even have to like try.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, Caroline, tell me if you disagree, but it sort of feels like that is of a piece with your reaction to Fernando's work, this sense that you're looking for an answer to this broad set of questions, and it just so happens that in the works of this particular author, that answer is presented.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that you follow the stories of the novels and they end up capturing so much of the setting and the political setting and the geographic setting really well just by being the stories that they are. I came upon Valley-esque very much by chance. It was a collection that really had an impact on me in the sense of it made me see my surroundings in a new way and made me experience lots of experiences that I have, you know, driving around the borderlands, being a journalist, from this perspective of sort of a touch of absurdity, but also a type of reality that's sort of different than other places.
I really appreciate Caroline's piece and how much thought Caroline put into it. Like, to be read that carefully is such an honor. And like, most of the time I forget that I am the writer, you know, in many occasions I forget, you know, because of the way that I pursue my own writing. Like, I think that when we think about literature of the border, the Southwest, it's a very stark kind of realism that is kind of like humorless, devoid of any kind of emotional or maybe even psychological depth. So my pursuit and my desire is always to try to add an extra layer of dimension or something to the region.
The way that you answered that is very interesting to me, the idea that you forget you're the writer. How do you think of yourself?
I'm like the medium. Like, I think about, like, sometimes like Shakespeare. Like, Shakespeare was a writer, but Shakespeare was an actor himself. He was a performer. He has to be aware of the performance of it. He has to be, in a way, performing in the room. So in many ways, I feel that he's like performing the play on the page. And in many ways, that's how I feel. I feel that I'm performing the novel on the page.
From the way that you have described your process, Fernando, there is something, as you said, very organic, very direct about that way of approaching the storytelling. And I wonder if that accounts for something else that you wrote, Caroline. You said, quote, "While Flores's work traffics in absurdity, I gradually realized its humor is tangled with a deep earnestness. Across his books, his characters confront corruption and find meaning through literature and music, even as their lives are indelibly marked by inequality, poverty, racialization, and militarization." I wonder, Fernando, what you make of that.
I don't know if I have anything to add to it. I mean, what is, to me, whenever I'm writing, all right, if let's say I'm writing on a typewriter, the moment I realize that I'm writing, like, oh my God, I'm writing, I stop writing.
Huh.
I stopped writing. I start thinking about technical things like that. Like, am I being earnest? Like, I cannot be conscious of these kinds of thoughts, because otherwise I feel like an imposter. I feel like a writer. I feel like I'm writing, like I'm performing the part of a writer instead of writing, you know?
Yes, yes, that makes sense. That makes sense. Well, it's making me realize that perhaps there's a flaw in my premise in terms of wanting to have this conversation with you both is this idea of, you know, having a conversation about how Caroline received your work as an iteration in the tradition of Borderlands literature and having you speak to that. From the way you're talking about this, I almost get the sense that you don't really think of it as Borderlands literature.
I mean, well, I guess, in you know, it'll be absurd for me to deny that it is that, you know? And I know also that even though terms can be flawed, sometimes they are necessary and sometimes they can be helpful, you know?
Yeah. Caroline, I guess maybe in closing, the line that I am coming back to from your piece, which is sort of where we started this conversation, is the novel is a personal form, which, you know, I think the conversation with Fernando is really illustrating that the act of creating the novel is also extremely personal. And yet, I know from your piece that you have derived a deeper understanding of place from Fernando's work. So having now had this conversation, where are you sitting with that original assertion?
Well, I think, you know, what Fernando was saying about always trying to like add more dimensions to literature and narrative sort of resonated with how I felt when I was reading the book, or even like the quote that you just read from my review about earnestness. Like, there are all these moments where the characters engage with music or books that they love, and you see that the characters have these really rich inner lives, and that's adding this whole dimension to whatever stereotypes we have about the Borderlands and what types of lives, you know, go on in the Borderlands. So I think that for me, it's like that sort of pursuit of the extra dimension that Fernando was describing that gives it that much earnestness.
Well, thank you both so much for having this conversation with me. Caroline Tracy is a journalist and wrote about Fernando Flores's work in Border Chronicle. And Fernando is the author of many books, most recently, Brother Bronte. Thank you.
Thank you both so much. Thank you, Caroline, once again, for that lovely piece and for everything you said here. And thank you, Sam, as well. Y'all have a very lovely day, okay?
You too. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you as well.
Good morning. It's the show on 91.5 KJZZ. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Water is a top-of-mind issue for many Arizonans. Between debates over the future of the Colorado River and groundwater, and conversations about the possibility of augmenting our water supply. But my next guest says these discussions are not just physical science ones, but social science ones as well. Amber Woodich is an anthropologist and ASU professor and author of a paper called Water Insecurity is Human: Why Social Science Must Be at the Core of Water Security Research and Practice. She joins me to talk more about this. And Amber, could you please summarize the argument you're making here?
The argument that I'm trying to make in the paper is that nowadays, almost no one's experience of water insecurity is dependent on the physical availability of water in their local environment. What determines how much water we have is the kinds of infrastructure we build, the economies that we build to manage the water, the values we put on the water. And so if we want to address problems of water insecurity, we have to start with the human parts of the system and work in concert with the hydrology and the biophysical parts of the system.
So do you draw a distinction then between water insecurity and water scarcity?
Yes. With water scarcity, we often are talking about the physical availability of water. And with water insecurity, we mean that human part. So how does the water scarcity fit with human systems to produce water abundance or water difficulties?
So what role then do you think social science plays in this? Because, for example, in a place like Arizona, there's clearly not as much water to go around as there has been in the past. There have obviously been cutbacks in different places, you know, negotiations on the Colorado River in terms of potentially cutting back more. So what role do you see social science playing in those talks and maybe in policymaking going forward, as opposed to maybe some of the physical sciences?
Sure. So I think there are two important roles. The most important one is that as we move to a future where water is perhaps scarcer or more contaminated or more difficult and expensive to make available, we have an opportunity as a society to rethink the way that we structure the systems we live in. And although it can be challenging, it's also exciting to think that we might be able to rebuild these systems in a way that is more consistent with our values and the lives we want to live. And I argue that social scientists are really core participants in this process, as are communities, as are governments, as is industry. But social scientists are so good at working with people to help them articulate what their values are and how they want to live their lives. So this is one main role. The other role is that social science has yielded a lot of very robust findings about the way the world works, and heeding those lessons can help us also build these better systems.
On a practical level, then, are you thinking about things like trying to figure out maybe where pipes should go and what kinds of pipes they should be, or whether there should be irrigation in particular neighborhoods, or if there are going to be cutbacks, thinking about who's living in the areas where there's going to be cutbacks and what their needs are and what do they have already relative to what the future might look like? Like, is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
Certainly, social scientists can assist with all those things, but I'll give an example of what I mean. For example, there are very robust findings in social science that the people most likely to experience water insecurity, even in a very water-rich environment, are people who experience poverty, people who live on low incomes. So about 5 years ago, the city of Phoenix asked to have presentations from social scientists to learn from these findings, and they created several very innovative, cutting-edge ways of dealing with this well-established tendency. So they have a citizen review board. They created rates that were affordable. They stopped a thing called shutoff. So when people were not able to afford their bills, they do not shut off their water anymore. Mm-hmm. Instead, they slow down the water so that people have enough to drink and cook and do basic hygiene tasks. And so this would be an example of a city putting in place new ways of managing water that build on the needs of certain communities and the social science.
Do you find that social scientists think enough about this topic? Like, among all the things social scientists think about and study, where do water insecurity and scarcity fall on that list?
I would argue that we have a very robust and sophisticated understanding of water insecurity. And one exciting development has then been, for many years, people believed that water insecurity was kind of located in low and middle income countries, and we didn't find it in high income countries. And thanks to the work of activists, but also social scientists, we now understand that there are pockets of quite severe water insecurity in the United States and other high income economies. And there are lots of things that we can do to address this.
What would you like to see social science's role be? And I guess, what should this field's involvement be as we continue to negotiate, for example, the Colorado River and talk about dwindling groundwater supplies and things like that? Like, what role should social science play?
Sure. I think social scientists can play many roles. I'll give an example. In the Arizona Water Innovation Initiative, which is housed at Arizona State University but funded by the governor's office, there are many roles for social scientists. We have policy analysts and lawyers who are helping with these negotiations. But we also have social scientists who are working with water insecure communities to help them build the future that they want. And so I would say there are a range of areas of expertise in social science, and all of them have a role to play.
And do you find that within the public, that all of this is sort of given equal consideration? And I ask because, you know, when we talk about water scarcity, water insecurity, so often the conversation has to do with how much water there is to go around, as opposed to how does it go around? How is it distributed? So I wonder if you find that you sort of have to explain to people, no, this is an important part of this in addition to the rest of it.
Well, you said that so beautifully, and it's so true. I find, particularly as a citizen of Arizona, and I get to circulate with just regular people, and they ask me about this, there is typically a great amount of fear about climate change and what it means for us living in the desert. And so that's what people come to me with, are questions about water scarcity and what does it mean for my future and what does it mean for my children's future. And so coming from a perspective that we have an extraordinary opportunity to teach the rest of the world how to conserve and manage our water in ways that are just and consonant with our values here in Arizona. And yeah, I think you're right about that.
I'm curious how you think about water use in, like you mentioned, a lot of folks who suffer from water insecurity are on the lower end of the economic spectrum. We talk, for example, about trying to plant trees to provide shade in these areas, which typically don't have a lot of shade, which is, of course, difficult in the summer here. Those trees, though, of course, need water. So, like, how do you think about how water might be needed and used for different uses in some of these communities?
Yes, this is a perfect example of where we have an opportunity here in Arizona to create sort of worldwide impact with our work, because this trade-off between how do we create enough green space and how do we wisely use water is one that we're still trying to figure out. We know that we need a lot of shade so that our heat islands don't get worse. We know that using native species is probably going to be a better way to do that. We also can begin to experiment with ways of allocating water so that it's specifically earmarked. Just in the way that the city of Phoenix did for low-income households, we can also earmark water for shade-providing trees that lower the temperature. And so this is, I think, a great example where we can have collaborations between ecologists and heat scholars and water scholars to create an optimal outcome.
Well, Amber, thanks so much for the conversation. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Amber Woodage is an anthropologist and professor at ASU. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. You know, artificial intelligence has vacuumed up a lot of the headlines about the tech industry of late. But as I was recently reminded by a piece in Wired magazine, AI is just one of many products that are pushing the boundaries of our collective comfort zone. Now, Mark, I have a question for you.
Okay.
Am I correct that you once owned a pet rabbit?
I did. His name was Baxter, and he was adorable.
I am sure that Baxter was a very adorable bunny, a good companion. But I have another question for you. Would you have liked him even more if he glowed in the dark?
That is not something I ever even thought about.
You know, few of us have. But that is exactly what someone named Josie Zahner is thinking about. Zahner is the main character in this Wired article that I was just mentioning, which was written by Emily Mullen. And I spoke to Emily recently about her very enigmatic subject.
You might remember Josie Zahner from a few years back when, in 2017, she publicly injected herself with CRISPR during a biohacking conference in San Francisco. And she's also done some other stunts, like giving herself a fecal transplant and a DIY COVID vaccine that she made in her garage, I think.
So uncontroversial person, it sounds like.
Yes, totally. Yeah, she's really pushed the boundaries of biotech and biohacking.
So we today are talking about a startup that she has been running in stealth mode until it started being written about in the pages of publications like Wired, called the Los Angeles Project. Tell us what the Los Angeles Project is up to.
Yeah, so the Los Angeles Project is all about making animals that are, in her words, more complex and interesting and beautiful and unique than ones that currently exist. So the first project they're working on is a glowing bunny rabbit.
Yeah. So before we get to the glowing bunny rabbit, can you just help us understand this CRISPR that Josie injected herself with and that she and the other folks at the Los Angeles Project are using to make these edits? What exactly is it? And what exactly does it allow biohackers like her to do?
Yeah, so CRISPR is short for clustered, regularly interspaced, short palindromic repeats. Say that three times fast.
I'm impressed you said it once.
It is a genome editing technology. And yeah, it's been around for a little over 10 years now. And CRISPR has become this incredible laboratory tool used by scientists to tinker with genes in plants, in animals, in cells of all kinds. And the reason why they are editing the animals at the embryo level is so that any change that they make with the gene editing will be present not only in that offspring, but if those animals go on to breed and have babies, those genetic edits will be carried on to the next generation. So this is called germline editing.
Okay. So let's come back to the glowing rabbit. One of the things that you point out in your piece is that it's not exactly new for scientists who are studying animals to make certain parts of those animals light up.
Yeah, totally. And okay. You're right that these aren't the first glowing animals ever created. So the edit that they're making here is they're adding a gene called GFP, which is commonly used by scientists to sort of visually track and monitor gene activity, a certain cellular process within an organism, you know, often to study diseases. The difference here is that the Los Angeles Project wants to gene edit animals with interesting characteristics that don't currently exist so that people can have these animals as pets. And yeah, the glowing bunny is, I think, a little bit of a gimmick, but also to, you know, kind of get people thinking about what is possible with this technology. So for instance, one of the things they want to do is make a hypoallergenic cat, a truly mm-hmm. hypoallergenic cat. I myself am highly allergic to cats. Mm-hmm. They are very cute animals, and I would love to just be able to put my face in one and, right. and, you know, cuddle a cat, but I can't. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I mean, the glowing bunny, a lot of people would think, whoa, like, why do that? But on the other hand, a lot of people would buy a hypoallergenic cat. So
right.
I don't know, where's the line here?
It seems like that's the question that Josie Zehner is really interested in. In the piece, she referred to the exciting opportunities available in, I think what she said is the pet space, which, you know, is a way that entrepreneurs often talk about new markets that might be interesting business opportunities. Like the grocery space is being upended by things like Instacart and that sort of thing. But here, the pet space is not just finding new ways of selling widgets. It's new ways of selling animals that, to go back to what you were pointing out earlier, are made. What are some of the other concerns that people have raised about this kind of genetically engineered animal experimentation?
It's interesting because humans have been breeding dogs and cats and lots of other animals for hundreds, probably thousands of years. And there are all sorts of animals now. You know, I'm thinking specifically of dogs and cats that have health problems because of humans selectively breeding
right.
them. So,
without
instance,
CRISPR.
right, without CRISPR, exactly. So, you know, we have flat-faced dogs like the French Bulldog that have these breathing impairments. Other dogs have joint issues, eye problems, hearing loss. There are certain cats that have bone and skeletal problems
yeah.
due to selective breeding. So this is not a new issue per se. And I think it does depend on what the edit is, right? I mean, I asked the company, well, what would be an ethical edit versus an unethical edit? And they had to think about that for a little bit. And mm-hmm. I think if a company does succeed at creating a glowing rabbit, for instance, and unveils that to the public, I think, is going to kind of have to decide here about whether this is okay or not, and whether they're going to buy this or not. I mean, there are all sorts of exotic pets that
right.
currently exist
right.
that CRISPR technology, gene editing technology kind of adds on another ethical layer, I guess.
Yeah. What you're saying, Emily, also makes me think about a point that you make in the piece, which is that the Los Angeles Project, which somewhat confusingly is based in Austin, Texas, the name seems to be an allusion to the Manhattan Project, which was, of course, the project that led to the development of the first atomic bomb.
Yes. I think that name was quite intentional.
All right. Well, Emily Mullen is a staff writer at Wired Magazine, and she wrote the piece that we've been discussing, Your Next Pet Could Be a Glowing Rabbit. Emily, thank you so much.
Thank you.
So, Sam, you asked the question before that interview if I would have liked my pet bunny if he glowed more. I think after hearing that, I'm good with the way he was.
Okay, but what are you going to do when they make it so that you can have a glowing radio host? What color would you choose?
After a good interview, I feel like you are kind of glowing.
That's right. That's right.
With pride, not with science.
No, I would rather glow with pride than science,
yes.
I think.
I think that's probably the safer way to handle that. Yes, absolutely. All right. Well, on that glowing note, that'll do it for this Thursday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, so much for being along. For the kind of glowing Sam Dingman, I am the not really glowing Mark Brody. Have a terrific rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow.